Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his huge 1982 bestseller, Blue Highways, William Leistheat Moon wrote, "A man who couldn't make things go right could at least go." And off he went, wandering America's back roads, telling the stories of singular people and towns alive and well against a backdrop of ever-widening interstates and strip malls. His investigative journeying, as he's called it, went on in Prairie Earth and River Horse. Now, 26 years after Blue Highways, he's back on the road again, 3 years and 16,000 miles through Idaho, Maine, Florida, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Texas, and more, still reveling in what the cookie cutter hasn't cut. This hour, On Point, William Leistheat Moon and Roads to Quaz. You can join the conversation. Do you dream of hitting the road, exploring corners off the superhighways? And what do we learn these days by seeking out the least traveled American path? Joining me now is William Leistheat Moon, author of Blue Highways, Prairie Earth, and River Horse. His new book is Roads to Quaz, an American Mosey. The Los Angeles Times calls it a great American Gothic. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram says, "Heat Moon brings back the notion of travel where the road is the journey and being open to what might be around the bend is the joy." He joins us from Seattle with his wife and fellow traveler in Roads to Quaz, Joanne Trogdon, or as he calls her, Q. William Leistheat Moon, Joanne Q, welcome. Thanks very much for being here. Thanks to you both.
Hello, hello, Tom. It's a delight.
Yes, it sure is, Tom.
Hi. Oh, what wonderful voices
Hi.
You have. It's nice to meet you over the radio. Gosh, you've been all over, and there's so much I want to ask you about and stories we want to hear. William Leistheat Moon, first to you. It's 26 years since Blue Highways. It's not as though you haven't been out the door since then, but is it the same country?
Yes and no. I think the most overwhelming change that that I notice when we take to the road now is the sprawling of small-town America. We know the cities are sprawling, but it's also happening in smaller places and smaller towns, villages. I call them in Roads to Quaz, Opoli from Opolis. The metro has been taken out of these places, but yet they still are suffering sprawl. So you can go into a town of 8,000 people, and if you get there at their rush hour, you're going to have a little traffic problem. So many of our two lanes now look like suburban strips in many parts of the country. That's the negative side. The upside is that a good many of our smaller communities now have signed on to various kinds of Main Street programs, and their main streets look more prosperous. They're returning the architecture, most of it which was done at the turn of the last century. Well, 2 centuries ago, I guess I should say now, they're returning that architecture to what it was, and they look better. They look historic. Mm. The Main Street America, I think, is beginning to find ways to fight, if I can use that word, against the sprawl marketeers that have taken so much economic life out of the heart of towns.
And this time you were kind of co-piloted and fully accompanied by Joanne, by Q. But take us – we want to hear about that. But take us back for a moment, because so many Americans will know you from Blue Highways, your very first. It was such an enormous bestseller. And I wonder, as a person, as a writer, how you look back on that now. It was a time in your life where you had lost a job, had lost a wife at that time, went out on this kind of ramble around the country and had such an enormous response to it from the American reading public. When you look back on that, William Leistheat Moon, how do you interpret that? What were people hungry for that it appears you brought?
Tom, I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I expected the book to sell a few thousand copies. I had no idea that it would, in its first 2 years, sell over a million. I just couldn't comprehend that, and I'm not sure that I can now. And I have a feeling that there are probably some readers, or excuse me, some listeners who are readers who are tuned in here who probably have a better answer than I do. But I would make one guess, and that is when Blue Highways first came out, we were suffering from problems in the Middle East. At that time, President Carter had failed to get the hostages out, and there was a huge national loss of self-esteem. And I think Blue Highways showed us that, certainly I hope it did, showed us that we have so much in this country that we can be proud of. I don't really like that word because sometimes we as Americans, we take it too far. But there is no reason to be holding our heads down. And it may be that now at this time with similar or greater problems in the Middle East that we might be ready for some reasons why we can hold our head up in the world. That's just one guess. And I also think that Blue Highways worked very hard to try to touch something genuine and authentic in American life, something that at that time was almost ignored, that is backroot America. And I think that so many of us have connections with that part of the country that it perhaps spoke. But again, I want to say that I have a feeling that there'll be some listener who will have a better answer than I do.
And maybe we'll hear it. Now, a lot of listeners, readers, will know you very well through your authorial voice, your travels in Blue Highways and River Horse and Prairie Earth. Joanne Q is right in the middle of this book, and they will not know her quite as well. I know she's sitting there right beside you in Seattle, but introduce us, if you would. You didn't have a wife when you set out on Blue Highways. Now you've got Q very much right there alongside. Would you be kind enough to introduce us to your wife?
Oh, indeed. Blue Highways is a trip where the greatest enemy for those 3 months I was on the road was desolation. Mm-hmm. It was a real struggle to try to keep going alone. And now, almost a generation later, having a fellow traveler is wonderful. Q is a lawyer, but she's one temporarily escaped from the practice of law, and she's working as a historian. She's writing a book, which we hope will be out next year, about William Clark of the Lewis and Clark Expedition. And I she won't say this, but I will. But mm-hmm. what she's discovered about William Clark is going to make us rethink who this man was. But I guess I should let her say more.
Joanne Q, if I yes. may, what was it like to travel 16,000 miles with this guy who was famous for traveling lonely and alone, the hangdog out there, you know, who's lost the wife? Now you're fully in the picture. How was it?
Oh, it was a great time. Yes, I truly enjoyed it, every minute of it. I saw places that were unlike places I'd ever seen before, particularly eating spots. And last week, just a tiny example, I saw the Texas Hill Country. I'd always wanted to see that before. We were off interstates and just kind of driving around at our leisure, and I just have seen beautiful terrain. So it has been a thrill.
Are you as into the back road side of this as William Leistit Moon famously is? I mean, here he's looking in Arkansas. You know, he looks at the map, and the places he loves are all the ones with the weird names: Greasy Corner, Figure 5, Number 9, Possum Grape, Tomato Hog Eye, King Doodle Knob. I mean, is that where your eye goes?
Yes, it is. I have to confess that.
It's not such a bad confession. And William, what about for you? Because, you know, throughout this book and all of yours, you write about the importance of talking to everybody that you run across. And we've all seen advice to travelers over the years to travel alone. Because when one travels alone, one is kind of an open circuit to everything, you know, we meet. Travel in a pair and, well, you can talk with your wife rather than the lady making pickle pie. Was it a problem for you?
No, not this time. Had I had somebody with me, even a dog, as say John Steinbeck did in his book, his road book, Travels with Charlie, mm-hmm. I'm not sure I could have written Blue Highways. I would have been distracted by the person or the pet, whatever it was. But this time, later in my career, I think I know how to isolate better and how to work better. But I have to say that traveling with, in this case, with a wife, opens certain things up. Approaching a woman now is does not present the same threat, if I can use that word.
With Q
to
at
a
your
stranger.
Side. Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's she's there, and so the woman sees there's a woman here, and often the interview will start revolving between a woman and Q, and so I, as the reporter, I could stand back and listen and jot down things. It really freed me up in many ways. And even with men, there's an example in Arkansas, in Hot Springs, Arkansas, where we were in a little tavern working puzzles. It was called Maxine's Puzzle Bar there on Central Avenue. Mm. We were working some of the little mechanical puzzles, and the guitarist spotted Q, who I have to say is an attractive woman. And he came up, and I suddenly vanished, which is great for a reporter. You know, I call it the fly on the wall system of reporting, and he talked to her so I could sit there and make notes. And you'll find somewhat of a complete conversation in Rhodes to Quaz between Q and this guitarist, mostly coming from him.
We've gone 10 minutes and haven't asked you the question, what the heck is Quaz? Q-U-O-Z.
Thank you for putting that question off. I knew when I titled the book Rhodes to Quaz, the first thing people say, what are you doing with a word like that? And when the subtitle is an American Mosey, what are these words that you're doing? And Q herself raised the question before the book came out. You're going to have a six-word title, two of them are Quaz and Mosey. Quaz, I don't want to say too much, Tom, because part of the discovery of Quaz is the heart of the book. But I will say this, it's a word that I did not make up. It was popular briefly in late 18th century England. I found it in reading one of the big, fat, unabridged dictionaries when I was looking at the letter Q and thinking about Q as a concept. But Quaz is, to start with, is anything mysterious and marvelous. As the book develops, readers will see that it also is something that connects us to something else. So Quaz can be a person, it can be a place, it can be a thing, an event. The heart of it is connection. There's a phrase I wish I'd used when writing the book. It just came to me the other day. But Quaz is silent and persistent energy, like a book itself. We have a book on a shelf, it sits there, and until it's opened, it's only potential energy. But once the reader opens the book and begins engaging in that world, then the energy releases itself.
All
in a
right.
similar way with a Quaz.
Hold the thought. We're ready to roll on that road. William Leistheat Moon is with us with Q. His new book is Rhodes to Quaz. We'll hear much more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour with William Leistheat Moon, chronicler of American backroads and byways, author of Blue Highways, Prairie Earth, and River Horse, about his latest book and journey told, Rhodes to Quaz. His fellow traveler and wife, Joanne Q, as he calls her, is with us as well from Seattle. And I should say, you can read an excerpt of Rhodes to Quaz at our website, onpointradio.org. Let me read just a little bit. Page 9 on Quaz. He calls it a noun, singular and plural, referring to anything strange, incongruous, or peculiar. At its heart is the unknown, the mysterious. William Leistheat Moon writes, for me, everything, when seen clearly in the depths of its existence, in its quiddity, is Quaz. And every road, every alley, the hall to your parlor, the course of a creek, the track of a comet, are all a route to Quaz for any traveler. We're at 800-423-8255. Ethel's calling from Tucson, Arizona. Ethel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. What do you know, Ethel?
Well, I wanted to tell William Leistheat Moon how much my husband and I have enjoyed his books. We've traveled in our motorhome for over 30 years, and his Blue Highways was part of our library in the motorhome, and we always were inspired to take the Blue Highways as much as possible. And I do remember especially looking for restaurants with seven calendars on the wall.
And remind us what Blue Highways are and were from that book, literally, Ethel.
Oh, literally. I can't remember the numbers of the highways, but traveling up through Oregon and up into the mountains as much as we could. It was a pretty big rig, so some of the places were impossible. But then we'd take our little tow vehicle and go exploring and always looking for those special restaurants with unusual things to eat. In fact, we even had another book that said, Eat Your Way Across America. So that was one of the things we enjoyed the most.
But these are literally the little pale blue highways on the map, the two-laners that are
right.
far from interstate. In 30 years you've been doing it. Did you learn how to do it, in a way, from William Leistheat Moon?
In some ways, yes, but it's mostly the enjoyment of rereading his book each time we make an adventure, and we really did use it a lot. And I'm so glad to hear that he's made another book. He's written another book, and I can't wait to read it.
William Leistheat Moon, what do you say to Ethel in Tucson, Arizona? She's kind of on your wavelength for 30 years now, Lucky Travelers.
Well, indeed, yes. Well, I hope the new book will serve as a guide too in certain ways. I have to say that. I think any reader should expect a different book this time, not simply because I'm accompanied by fellow traveler Q, but, you know, I'm a generation older now, and I've tried to write a different book. I really did not want to repeat Blue Highways. I wanted to make this new book, Roads to Quaz, as different as I could, while still being somewhat of the same man. But, you know, 25 years now, there have been changes.
What does it mean to be an older traveler? You're very upfront about that. You sort of embrace the title, the form. But what does it mean day to day on the road to your eye, to your interaction with the country you cross?
Well, I think one of the good things is that there are many things now that I've seen so many times I don't need to pay too much attention to those, and I can focus in on things that are new or things that I've not had time to spend with before. So you'll see in this book that it's six journeys spread over 4 years, 16,000 miles. Blue Highways covered 13,000 miles. So this is a longer journey, but both in time and in space. But the point that we would try to do is we'd set out from where we live near Columbia, Missouri, and reach a destination. Let me say the Southwest, for example. So we leave Columbia. At the end of that trip was Alamogordo, New Mexico. Not quite uh-huh. Tucson, but Alamogordo. And I wanted to meet a woman there who had been writing me letters for almost 10 years. I'd never met her. But these were peculiar letters, interesting letters, articulate letters. Mm. And I wanted to meet this one because she was living in 117 square feet at the back end of a trailer.
That's about 10 by 10, 10 by 11.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
And even though she was not poor, she was not uneducated, she was not unattractive, she was at the time pushing 70. People around Alamogordo took her for a bag lady because she would go about town cleaning up after them. And what she made from recyclable containers there she would sell. She was living on $30 a week. She had received inheritance of $70,000, given it to the Nature Conservancy. They sent her a small annuity, so she supplemented that by picking up recyclable gear. And her life was living with as small a footprint as possible. I say in the book that she had the carbon footprint of a cat. My point here, though, is that we set out to meet Jean Ingold, her name. Those miles between Columbia, Missouri and Alamogordo, New Mexico, were all the serendipitous miles. We had no idea what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. So the book will have a loose destination in mind, but everything between home and that destination pretty much was open to serendipity.
You can almost dip in anywhere. I wish you'd give us a little feeling of your meeting with this longtime correspondent of yours, whom you had never met before, Jean Ingold in Alamogordo, New Mexico. You went out, on this instance, Q was left behind. You were out at night to meet Jean. Could you read just a little bit for us, William Leesteaton,
yes.
From Roads to Quaz?
The night was dark as all get-out when I stopped the car to stumble my way toward the pallid glow of a shabby house trailer. One of the stumbles noisy enough, or maybe it was my cuss word, to bring out the hounds of hell, a pair of charging mongrel pit bulls. I couldn't see the dust the dogs are raising, but I could smell it. A guttural voice cursed the curs into fang growls, and it inquired about my approach with the indirection of, "Are you one of them county morons?" I said I was the moron looking for Jean Ingold's trailer. "Next one north." The punctuation provided by an empty beer can pitched at the once again barking mutts that put one into a satisfying yelp. I fumbled forward toward a strip of thin pines, shadows against the sky, dimly illuminated by the dimmest of light from a dim window in a dimmed house trailer. I called her name and went to the screen door, and there she stood, her hair freshly washed and in rollers, and she, slender, a small lark, the single bulb inside outlining her shape through a nightie worn down to sheerness, more a long veil than a gown, and her voice in surprise. "I thought you were arriving tomorrow," she said. "I go to bed at 9 in the warm weather, but I'm glad you made it." Opening the door, holding it for me, she said, "Maybe you can help me move my cot outside. I think it's too warm tonight to sleep in here." So we moved it. Later she would lie down near the pines, covering herself with only a thin sheet, and she would watch the desert sky slip away over the mountains until she too slipped away into sleep. With no place to sit under the trees and but a single chair in her single room, she offered it to me while she sat on the floor, her legs under her like a child at a storytelling. Jean Shira Ingold was 18 months shy of 70, and she watched me with side glances, speaking as her eye searched the walls for what to talk about, and she gave frequent quick chuckles to things she said, although a few of her sentences had a somber cast to them.
William Lee's Teat Moon, reading from Roads to Quoz, there meeting a longtime correspondent and admirer. His wife, Joanne Trogdon, Q, is with him in Seattle. Joanne, Q, what was it like to send your guy out there for this assignation in the middle of the night in Alamogordo?
Well, I wondered what was going on, but I knew enough about Jean that there was no cause for alarm, no worry, and met her the following day and was quite taken with her life and her occupations, her walking along the roads, picking up trash and really finding ways to make her little corner of the world a better place, as Will talks about in Quoz.
And she does. And I couldn't help wondering in this book where you find yourself in so many kind of gnarly, peculiar, wonderful corners of the country. But William, I wonder if you see yourself as in this kind of quest or journey. Are you plunging into the country or are you avoiding contemporary America in some way by going for its, you know, it's corners, it's quoz.
Well, if we define contemporary America as franchises and consumption and heavily clustered people, yes, I suppose I am trying to get away from that. But if contemporary America is defined as what's going on in the country, where people are living and breathing and making their lives, then no, it's an attempt to enter into those lives, even though they may differ in some ways from urban lives. With our communications we have today, mm-hmm. rural America is certainly far more linked to urban America than it has ever been before. That's probably obvious to say that. So when we go into a small town, a dime box, Texas, of the country, you really still feel that contemporary America is just around the corner if it's not there on Main Street itself.
And is it a healthy America that you found on your back roads in Roads to Quoz?
Well, yes, I think so. It's probably as healthy as any place else one might find in the country. In some ways, I think it may be healthier in that these people tend to be, not everyone, of course, but tend to be much more linked and connected with the place that they live in. They really belong to that territory. Mm-hmm. They speak of their territory with pride and with a strong link. And I'm not sure that always happens in an urban setting, especially with the young.
We've got so many people who want to speak with you. Let's go to Williamston, Michigan, and Jerry. Jerry, you're on the air with William Lee's Teat Moon.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well. What do you know, Jerry?
Well, I just wanted to let William Lee's Teat Moon know that Prairie Earth inspired myself and my wife to lease a house on a ranch in the Flint Hills of Kansas after we retired.
Wow.
We're in Greenwood County, which is just a little south of Chase,
mm-hmm.
and we've been doing this for 10 years, and we've met a lot of fun and interesting people. We spend 2 months of the year out there. We go in June and then back again in September so that we avoid Kansas's July and August.
Right.
But we've met a lot of interesting people and really kind of immersed ourselves in the culture out there.
And what was it? Of course, William Lee's Teat Moon went very deep on Chase County in Prairie Earth. What was it about his deep depiction of that county and its very soil that had you sort of, you know, up and go, Jerry?
Well, first of all, I grew up in Wichita, and mm-hmm. when we would go back home to visit, we always drove the turnpike through Chase County. Our real effort was to try to find a place in Chase County, but we were not successful in locating a place to lease there. But the area where we are is very similar to Chase County.
And back you went. William, you're sending people on the road. You're sending them to ground in Kansas. Are you feeling responsible for shaping these lives?
Well, sometimes I wonder what kind of contribution I've made to the exhaust that have been blown across America from roadworks. I should say there that Q and I have begun changing the way that we travel. As I mentioned, Roads to Quoz takes place over 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we finished our travels late last year, it was clear to us that there is something to global warming and climate change, and that we needed to do something a little different. So we've taken up different kinds of travel now. We recently took a raft down the Yampa River in northwestern Colorado. We biked on the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal towpath from the Cumberland, Maryland, down to Washington, D.C., Georgetown, actually. We took a canoe across the Okefenokee Swamp. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to cut our exhaust down a little bit. But when you're working that hard to travel, it gets more difficult to write sometimes when you're more exhausted.
Right.
And it's tough to take notes when you're on a bicycle or paddling a canoe. I've tried it, and maybe something will come from those in terms of writing. But right now, it's mainly just our continuance of exploring America.
Hard to huff and puff away on that bike and take notes at the same time. Let's get a call from Rutland, Vermont. John, you're on the air with William Leachtheap Moon and Q.
Hi, Tom and William. This is terrific, a great coincidence, because I just got finished running the River Horse across America with you. And I'm just... going to reach 70 around January, and I've been through three wives because of my wanderlust, and I was really impressed with your command of the English language. I actually have a dictionary sitting on my chest while I read your books.
He uses a lot of it, wouldn't you say, John?
Yes, I'm still learning what C-O-I-G-N means and T-R-I-D-I-N-G, triding, and I haven't found it yet. But his comments, he makes a lot of off-the-cuff remarks, humor, and historical tidbits are just wonderful. Missing butt on Litbit's raw area, Indian response to Christianity, had, all that stuff, the places where he eats. And I get out to Oregon twice a year to a little town named Yahats, and it's just a great place. I've lived in Woodstock, Vermont, and they're both similar in their environmental concerns and the way they live their lives. And I just wanted to recommend a great coffee house there called the Green Salmon, because I noticed that he has made a lot of notes on various places where he has dined, and I've got them written down in the book, and I can't wait to go out there and enjoy them.
John, it sounds like exactly a William Leachtheap Moon kind of recommendation, the Green Salmon. That's terrific. And thanks very much for your call. That of course, River Horse, was it a 20-foot boat with a couple of outboard motors, William?
22 feet. Uh-huh.
And the waterways that you use to get coast to coast there, up the Hudson and then right on.
Yes, I should say, Tom, that we went from New Jersey, Elizabeth, New Jersey, went out into the Atlantic Ocean under the Verrazano Narrows Bridge and then proceeded up the Hudson across the Erie Canal, a little piece of Lake Erie, the Allegheny River, I'm doing this fast, the Ohio River, the Mississippi, the Missouri. I had to pull the boat out to get over the Rocky Mountains and then put into the Salmon River, the Snake River, the Columbia, to the mile marker 8 in the Pacific Ocean west of Astoria, Oregon.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with William Leachtheap Moon, chronicler of American backroads and byways, about his latest book and journey told, Roads to Quoz, an American Mosey. William Leachtheap Moon, you will have many readers who know the story from having read you for years, but we've got a lot of young listeners who may not. Where did you get that name?
Let me try to do the nutshell version of it, Tom. Mm-hmm. My background is English, Irish, and Osage.
Osage as in Native American.
Yes. They were residents of along the Missouri River, Lower Missouri River, in the state of Missouri before the coming of the Euro-Americans, and later were moved to Oklahoma, and they still are a strong presence, a tribal presence in Oklahoma. The last full blood that we knew was born in July, the moon of heat. My father in the 1930s wanted to honor that side of his ancestry, so he took the name Heat Moon. He used it primarily in Boy Scouting. He was a scoutmaster for years. When my elder brother came along, he wanted to have a name with some kind of connection with the family, mm-hmm. so he became Little Heat Moon. I, being 6 years younger, when I came along, that left me as Least Heat Moon. So I've had the name since 1952. It was used only in the family and among some scouting things. But it seemed to me, when the time came to write Blue Highways, publish it in 1983, that being a reporter, it could serve a nice end to have two names, so I could be known to readers under one name, but when I go into some place to do some reporting, I could go in with a certain amount of anonymity and ask some questions. In Prairie Earth in Chase County, Kansas, I was there for a year doing my reporting before anybody other than one person whom I worked with discovered that I was the fellow who had written Blue Highways. So I got different stories until I got discovered. Then stories started changing, sometimes for better and sometimes for worse.
In this book, you acknowledge, though, that an awful lot of people have read your books over the years, and you may have sat down next to them in Yazoo City, where I've had a wonderful lunch as well, or elsewhere. I mean, they're out there. Are they not hard to avoid at this point, or do you travel anonymously?
No, I'm anonymous as best I can. And once in a while, somebody will recognize me here or there, but... writers, at least my kind of writing, we're not rock stars, we're not movie stars, we're not athletes. We don't get recognized much. It happens occasionally after a book comes out, but then within a year it disappears. So I fall back into anonymity, which is the way that I do prefer it.
Joanne, Q, is he giving it to us straight there, or do they?
Sure is.
They don't crowd around and tear out locks of his hair and.
Well, every once in a while, someone will recognize him, and we call it the heat moon look. But no, he prefers anonymity, and that suits him very well. That's suits me, too.
Yes, I'm sure. Let's go to Todd in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Todd, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. As somebody who has lived in the back of his truck for 7 years, I can really relate to that lady you were talking about earlier.
In her 10-by-11 place in Alamogordo, New Mexico, yeah.
Yes, that really strikes home with me. My question is, did you ever encounter a lot of problems living a nomadic lifestyle from people who didn't agree with that type of lifestyle? And I'd just like to know if you'd ever gotten into problems because of that.
Well, in Blue Highways, occasionally I would have the police at night come and rouse me and make me move to a different place. Sometimes they would direct me to the police station where they said it's safe to park there and we won't harass you anymore. But other than that, no, I really haven't encountered problems. The people who might be suspicious of me because at that time I was traveling in a van, I had a beard. Just kept their distance. Other people were intrigued by it. And we need to remember here, of course, that all of us in America are the descendants of people from the other side of the hemisphere. Mm-hmm. We are all descendants of travelers. So I think there is something deep within Americans when they see a motorcycle come through, when they see a van come through. Somebody clearly is moving cross country. Mm-hmm. There can be a certain allure to them to talk to that person and find out, you've been bicycling across America. What have you seen?
Cuts both ways and an allure at the same time with that. Todd, thanks for calling. Let's go to Salisbury, Massachusetts. And Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
All the stories of people living in small spaces, people living in back of a truck struck a chord with me because I've lived on a boat for the past 5 years in New England, winter and summer.
Lucky you.
It's a very small space. It's not 10 by 10 quite. But it's beautiful, and I've lived in this area for 20 years, but it wasn't until I moved aboard and lived full-time off the grid that I began to see all of the sights around me in a different way.
Winter's coming. Will you be iced in when winter comes, Jim?
My children call me Shackleton. They live about 5 miles away. But they also think it's beautiful. They spent Christmas aboard last year, and we went out in the cockpit and looked at constellations and stars that I don't think most people see when they're living indoors or when they're commuting up and down the highway. But when you slow down a little bit and live a little bit closer to the earth, you begin to see those things. So I moved my boat this morning from my summer residence on the Merrimack River over to Hampton Bay for the winter. I saw three seals and a loon and an eagle. Those are all things in a very urban part of Massachusetts that probably most people don't notice.
Just in one morning. William Q, you know, these last two callers, Todd and Jim, sound like exactly the kind of people that you'd be drawn to on the road, that you'd turn to and want to know more about, if I've got you right, William.
Oh, I'm sure they are. I operate generally with the notion that I picked up from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who one time wrote something along the lines that every person whom he meets is in some way his master meaning teacher. I try to go about with that in my head, so that anyone whom I meet, she or he has a story to tell me. If I can make the proper connection between me and him or her, it doesn't always work, but much of the time it does. There's at least one story there. It's an operating theory, I think, that sort of underwrites my books.
You know, I come from a family of talkers and conversation starter-uppers. My parents would do that anywhere, all over the country, with anyone at any moment. But it's lately I look around and it looks a little bit dated or antiquated to me. I'm not sure people start conversations up in quite the way that they once did, or assume, you know, hey, we're all just fellow Americans here, and let's talk about the details of our lives. Are people as open to that today as they were 26 years ago, Bill?
Well, in urban settings, it perhaps may raise just a bit of suspicion to start talking with somebody. I think, Tom, that perhaps that is one of the reasons that we started the first journey in Roads to Quaz. We started by following the Ouachita River from near the Oklahoma state line through Arkansas and on down into Louisiana, near to where it joins the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Because when you're in the South, people are going to talk. They treat language like music, and you warble a few notes, they warble a few notes, and the next thing you know, you have a conversation going. And it put me back in the frame of mind, perhaps, of Blue Highways, where I also started in the South for a different reason. That was because it was cold, and I was living in the back of a truck, so I wanted to get to warm weather. But by traveling in the South first, there were so many conversations and stories flowing all over the place that it reminded me that I am a storyteller. In fact, the second chapter in the book is a story out of Arkansas about a woman whom I met on the Mississippi, the Delta Queen on the Mississippi River.
Yeah, wonderful
story. The great old steamboat.
Yeah, I know it well.
She told this story. I heard it one night, and I was taking a few notes. Then I went back the next morning, and I asked her, please tell me the story again so I can take fuller notes, because I'd like to use this one day. So the second chapter of Roads to Quaz is her story. Now, to find a story like that up in the north-central part of the country, the stories are there, but it may be a little more tricky to get them to come out. But in the South, if you can't get somebody telling you a story, probably the traveler needs to get to see a counselor and find out what's going on.
Especially with that kind of loquacious detail about Northern Lights showing up in the southern countryside and her daddy burning down the still in the backyard and everybody laying straight out in bed waiting for the second coming. That was quite a story indeed. You got off the Delta Queen. Q is William always the conversation starter, or were you diving in on this too?
Well, he's not always the conversation starter. As he said, sometimes when women are there and there needs to be, you know, opening
a little
made.
Icebreaker. With,
mm-hmm. Yeah, a little icebreaker. Then that's quite easy to do. And then we'll get the gab going, so to speak. And he'll know when to come in and, you know, start trying to get a story.
Right. Once you've got it revved. Let's get a call from Boonville, Missouri. Great name. Hi, Julie. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Trogdon. I'm sure you don't remember me, but you had me in a world literature class in Stevens many long years ago, and I just wanted to give you an attaboy. I enjoy your books.
William Trogdon, as in not the authorial name, but the actual name of William Lee Street Moon.
Yes,
one of your old students there, sir.
What is your last name?
McGinty.
McGinty then at Stevens?
Yeah, I brought the Carmina Burana tape.
Oh, my heavens.
Oh.
Yes, Julie was the one who I was fumbling to try to find out the name of Carl Orff's great composition, Carmina Burana. And Julie was the one who gave me the name for it. I was fumbling for it. And I have three different recordings of that, one for an auto and one in my studio and one in the house. So, yeah, I'm still indebted to you.
Julie, did you
yes,
know he was
so
going to
much.
Be one of the famous travelers of our time?
No. No, I think this was before Blue Highways. Hit babies.
It was.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, thanks for making the reconnection from Boonville, Julie.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Let's get another from Providence, Rhode Island. Frederick, you're on the air with William Leastheat Moon and Q.
Hello, Tom and your guest.
Hi.
Mr. Leastheat Moon, earlier in the conversation, Tom asked whether you've noticed changes in the quality and the character and the fabric of American towns since you wrote the first book. And I'd like to ask a slightly different question, and that is, in the intervening years since you set out from Columbia, Missouri, have you noticed changes in the values, the character, the core qualities of the American people? Not the towns, but the people.
Mm-hmm.
A quarter century later, are people still people? What have you noticed?
Oh, I find that if the traveler, the stranger who comes into town, breaks the barrier of silence, then the stories typically will start flowing, and I see people there as genuine and as real as I saw a generation ago. I'm not sure there's been any huge change in that way. I think because deep within us all is the wish for stories, to hear stories, to tell stories, because it's a way of linking with each other. I suppose that if one looked at the internet now and the growth of blogging and so on, it's another expression of that. I prefer to do it face to face. I'm not a blogger, but a good cafe with a round table there of the locals, man, that's a kind of blog site of a primitive type, which I enjoy.
But is it really a character eternal? I mean, you go for the sort of Mark Twainian angles of life. I mean, he talked about variegated vagabondizing, maybe his version in Roughing It of your investigative journeying. But with all the demographic changes in this country, immigration, different patterns of living and densities of living and ways of interaction, the internet and all the rest, I mean, is there really, can William Leastheat Moon keep going back to the countryside and finding that Cracker Barrel, decade after decade, or does it just become something else at some point?
Well, I don't think I'll probably be going back back to write anyway about stories like this. But I think I'm a little uneasy, Tom, with the word Cracker Barrel, because that implies that these people may be more country and more simple than indeed they are.
Well, far be it for me to say simple, but there's a kind of country character that you glory in and glorify in a way. And I wonder if at a certain point, what percent of people are farmers now? What percentage of people are really sawing their own logs?
Oh, yes. Well, even though the people who appear in the new book, Roads to Quaz, are small town or rural people, I don't believe, I'm trying to remember the whole book in a way, I don't believe there's anybody in there who was actually tilling the land. They're doing other things. They're doing most of the same things that people in cities are doing. And keep in mind that, for example, Dick Smart, who appears, he's the inventor of the rail cycle, which we might talk about. Mm. He lived in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, which is a city. And that story takes place outside of Coeur d'Alene, but I met him there. And so we're dealing with a dentist here, a city person. Gene Ingold, whom we talked about earlier, grew up in Washington, D.C., and Alamogordo is a city. So I think it's a little probably inaccurate to think too much of the people in this new book, Roads to Quaz, as being really even rural. Yes, not large cities, but they are people who are sophisticated, certainly.
Q, what did you come away thinking about the America that you saw in those 16,000 miles? Is it America where you'd want to sort of throw your flag down anywhere and plant yourself there, where you'd choose carefully where you actually lived and would have more taste for one spot or another? A healthy country you saw?
Yes, healthier than I might have expected, certainly from exposure to interstates. It did make me appreciate, though, where we live in Columbia, Missouri, for very practical reasons. One can reach any corner of the country and get back home in less time than one can, in just if you had your home base anywhere else.
You're so kind of in the middle of things there.
In the middle of things, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed.
And will you keep at it, William Leastheat Moon, with your canoe and bike and raft maybe? Or is there a point at which the mind travels and you travel a little less physically?
Well, I think that we probably travel as much, but in shorter segments. Blue Highways was a 3-month journey. River Horse was 4 months. And I really don't want to take on any like that anymore. I'm pushing 70, and although I can still play basketball, I find that I like to come home. I love, as I say in the book, I love to leave home and hit the road. What a wonderful feeling it is, those first few days especially. And there's not much better than those that last day of arriving again and finding the house is not burned to the ground, it's still standing, and to get in and take a shower and sit back in my chair where I like to read. Oh, what a wonderful sensation that is. But sitting in a chair and reading makes me want to get on the road again, so I'm going back and forth on these. But we stay out less time now, I think.
The joys of taking off and the joys of coming home. William Leistheat Moon and Joanne Trogdon Q, the wife and fellow traveler, joining us today from Seattle. Thank you very, very much for being with us. It's it's really a pleasure hearing about your latest. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, Tom, it was a delight, and thanks to all the listeners for their wonderful comments.
Yes, thank you very much. It's been a good time.
It's been fun. William Leistheat Moon and Q, the new book is Roads to Quaz and American Mosey. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.